It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to.
And it's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's hot in Wisconsin with heat advisories for a lot of the state. We want to know how you are coping with the weather. You can go and post on the Central Time Facebook page and tell us about it.
Coming up later on Central Time, we'll look at what's going on in the minds and bodies of heroin users. It's part three of a six-part series on the drug's reemergence in Wisconsin. But first, we're going to be talking about the Rolling Stone cover controversy.
It features a Dylan-esque photo of suspected Boston bomber Jokhar Tsarnaev. And the question is, the response has been, is this glorifying the person who allegedly committed a really horrific crime?
Well, our guest is Kelly McBride. She's a senior faculty member at the Poynter Institute. Kelly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we've got a picture of this cover on the Central Time Facebook page, but I want to start with having you describe sort of the feel of this picture. It has been described in the press as being reminiscent of Bob Dylan. Do you see it that way?
Well, it's definitely classic Rolling Stone. So you could say Bob Dylan, you could say Jim Morrison. Interestingly enough, it's also reminiscent of the Rolling Stone Charles Manson cover. So it's not completely out of character for Rolling Stone to have this type of cover, but it definitely is ambiguous especially with the image alone, in terms of what they're trying to convey.
Would you call it sympathetic?
Well, I mean, not necessarily. It says, you know, on there, it says the bomber, the Boston bomber. So it's not, there's type that's clearly not sympathetic. I think what has people so upset, though, is he is such a classic, good-looking, typical teenager, typical American teenager, that everybody knows a kid like this, and it does seem like it's meant to make you look right into his eyes.
Well, the picture itself has been out there; it's been floating around for months in the news, but now it's on Rolling Stone, this iconic magazine. Does that change the way we perceive it?
Well, it obviously changes things for some people, because there's been this huge uproar. People are really upset about this. And, you know, several retail companies have said they're not going to sell the magazine in response to the uproar on social media. I'm struggling with why the Rolling Stone treatment caused so much fury with people. And I got to say, I can't exactly put my finger on it, but I think it has to do with that juxtaposition. I also think it has to do with most of the people who are seeing this aren't reading the article. Rolling Stone released the cover first as a tease for the article. The article is basically an explanation of how an all-American kid can become a mass murderer and a terrorist.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned social media, and I've read a smattering of the comments about it, and some of them say things like, you know, I can't believe Rolling Stone is doing this, they're turning him into a martyr, you've got him on the cover of this iconic magazine, which, you know, some people are perceiving as a glamour shot, and they're saying they're never going to buy Rolling Stone again, they're never going to read it again, and then you've got other people saying, you know, hang on, let's just read the article. So it's a response across the board there.
Yeah, and you know, I think that a lot of the people who are really upset are not regular Rolling Stone readers. So this cover and this article makes perfect sense to me for Rolling Stone to do this, because Rolling Stone is trying to explain youth culture. And one of the ways that you can explain youth culture is when somebody who is young does something horrific and you look at why that person did this and what that person's life was like. So I do think that for some people, they're just not regular Rolling Stone readers. So they see this because it's being passed around on social media, and they're reacting viscerally without having read the article.
Well, if you look at what Rolling Stone has said, they are standing by their cover. And here's a quote from what they say. They say it falls within the traditions of journalism and Rolling Stone's longstanding commitment to serious and thoughtful coverage of the most important political and cultural issues of our day. And they also point out that their readers are this age, like you said. Does that address it to you? Should that put it to bed?
I actually think that that was a pretty good statement. They explain themselves. They're not backing down from it. And I don't really see an ethical reason for them to back down from it. It doesn't overtly do anything to glorify or justify what the bombing in Boston. And I think that the article itself is really well done. It's a pretty well-written, intriguing, fascinating piece of journalism.
But then let's look at a parallel one. So now if you look at another act of violence against yourself, a suicide, prevailing wisdom is that you don't talk about suicides. You don't glamorize the person who killed themselves because it will inspire other people to do the same thing. They'll think they'll get some sort of notoriety. And I guess the argument here is that, look, if you have any sort of unstable ego involved here, which you have in these acts of violence, someone can say, hey, I do something like this. I get lots of people killed. I get my cover on Rolling Stone.
So that's really fascinating, especially in the light of the fact that there is this cult of personality forming around Jokar. There are people who think he's innocent. There are people who defend him. The same is true of the guy who shot up the theater in Aurora, Colorado. So the reality is with the internet the way it is now, People can glorify disgusting, despicable people no matter what. And in fact, a small number of people always will. One of the consequences of not reporting on suicide and of not explaining how people become alienated and disaffected is that that we never understand what happened. So as a society, we have trouble. We actually have a really hard time preventing suicide, which, as it turns out, is almost entirely preventable because we don't have a lot of information about suicide. I know that because I'm working with a council, and they're trying to get the media to change how they cover suicide. They'll also tell you that glorifying it causes harm. But I think that journalists have to figure out how to report the facts in the style and manner that they do well, you know. So whatever your modus operandi is, and Rolling Stone clearly has a well-defined modus operandi, and then also minimize harm. And I think Rolling Stone did a pretty good job on this one.
Do we have to look at the platform, though? I mean, they are Rolling Stone, and it's a cliche about making it, getting your picture on Rolling Stone. Even today, I know that song is like from the 70s, or it's an old song, but
you just dated yourself.
But it's still something that matters. And I wonder, could they have put a different picture on that cover and run the same article? Maybe it didn't have to be Jokar Tsarnaev. Maybe it could have been a victim on the cover.
Well, sure, they could have. And they didn't have to put any picture on the cover. You know, there are lots of articles in Rolling Stone, and only one of them dominates the cover. Others are teased to from the cover. So they had options. But I suspect, and I haven't talked to anybody at Rolling Stone, but I suspect that this is the most interesting article in the magazine. And if that's the case, you want that to be your dominant cover art.
Comment here from Reginald on Facebook. He says the cover is people talking, and that is exactly what they want. And isn't that what every media outlet wants? What do you say to that?
Well, you know, that's actually a really good point. It could be that Rolling Stone completely anticipated this controversy and is totally fine with it.
Well, do you think it's going to unfold from here? Is Rolling Stone going to see backlash?
Well, you know, they already have. So Walgreens has said they're not going to sell the magazine. It could be that there will be a backlash to the backlash as well. I wonder if, as more people read the article and more people consider what Rolling Stone is and how this fits within the tradition of Rolling Stone, I wonder if people will walk, if those retailers will walk back from their decisions not to sell.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for being on and talking about it today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That was Kelly McBride, a senior faculty member at the Poynter Institute, and we do have a picture of the cover up on our website if you'd like to check it out and see what people are talking about.
Coming up, it's the next installment of WPR's Heroin series. Today, we'll look at what's going on in the minds and bodies of heroin users. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're continuing our six-part series on Wisconsin's heroin epidemic, and today we're just talking about it from the addict's perspective.
People become addicted to heroin for a variety of reasons. With that addiction comes many personal struggles. Maureen McCollum in La Crosse introduces us to Gina, who has her own story of addiction.
Today is a bad day for Gina. She's curled up on a living room couch with the TV on mute. The petite 46-year-old, who doesn't want her last name used because of the stigma attached to addiction, looks calm and relaxed, but she's exhausted and in pain. It's only been a few weeks since Gina last used heroin, so her mind and body ache from the drug's absence. More than anything, her back is killing her. She can't take anything to numb the pain like she used to.
I first started using probably back in 2003. I had a back surgery and started out as opiates. Pain meds.
Gina was prescribed drugs to help her recover. Soon after, her 14-year-old son was diagnosed with cancer. Then her teenage daughter got pregnant. To cover up that pain, she started taking more pills, then eventually turned to the cheaper alternative, heroin.
And I remember thinking, heroin, because if you hear that word heroin, you think, oh no, you know, that's a bad drug.
But she was instantly hooked.
It was the best, I'd have to say the best high, you know, I've ever had. Yeah. It's hard. It's difficult. Yeah, I mean, you just get high and you get relaxed and you really honestly forget about everything. Forget every worry problem you have.
She eventually needed more and more of the drug to reach that euphoric high. Over the course of a year, Gina tried to get clean countless times, but would experience the intense body aches, nausea, and diarrhea that accompany heroin withdrawal.
I was doing it just to not go through the withdrawals and the sickness. Because there were so many times I tried quitting, and I'd get 24 hours in and be so sick, you would literally crawl to your car to go get to use so that you weren't sick.
Last fall, Gina went through detox and ended up on Suboxone, a legal painkiller that helps people kick opiate addictions by blocking the drug's effects. It worked for Gina. She quit using heroin and didn't even crave it.
I was doing really, really good. My insurance ran out. 2 weeks after my insurance ran out, and I ran out of the Suboxone, I relapsed.
Heroin was back, taking away Gina's physical pain. But with it came guilt. One day, Gina and her daughter were driving around La Crosse with her granddaughter in the back seat. The cops pulled them over, and Gina was arrested for a DUI and attempted possession of a narcotic. Her daughter wasn't arrested. Gina says it was much worse. Her granddaughter was placed in the foster care system.
And my daughter lost her daughter then. That was the day she lost her, which I have to live with every day of my life that we lost her because of what I did.
While Gina awaits trial, she lives in a group home for female offenders. She says the house is a godsend, and if she won $1 million, she would open as many of these houses as she could. Gina's determined to get heroin out of her life once and for all.
And looking, I know what I'd like to be, where I'd like to be 5 years down the road. I know what I'd like to do, but I can't look at that picture yet. Because it's a struggle making it through every day.
In the meantime, Gina says she has 3 goals. Find a good job, help her daughter get clean, and get her granddaughter out of foster care. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
And thank you to Maureen for that report.
Here with us now to discuss the experience that addicts face is Keith Leese. He's executive director of the Cooley Council on Addictions. Keith, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard a vivid story of Gina's addiction to heroin. She's not alone. This is a pretty common story, isn't it?
It is, and unfortunately, it's increasing pretty significantly all across the state. So it's definitely a challenge that we're being forced to face right now.
Now, what goes on, and again, Gina just told us some of this, but what goes on in someone's mind when they take heroin?
Well, the brain turns heroin back into morphine, and it affects the opiate receptors not only in the brain but throughout the body, which is where that pain reduction can come from, and it makes it very, very powerful, a very feel-freeing, free feeling, loose, carefree, and not just the physical and the mental but emotional pain. It all goes away while they're high.
Well, and it sounds like part of the thing about addiction isn't just wanting to recreate that experience. It's wanting to get over withdrawal symptoms. Can you talk about what happens with those symptoms?
Well, there are quite a few different symptoms of withdrawal, you know, restlessness, insomnia, diarrhea, you know, severe muscle and bone pain, cold flashes, fevers, muscle spasms. It's extremely painful. It's extremely frightening for people that are struggling with this to go through, and it's one of the main reasons that people struggle. They can mentally want to quit this drug, you know, and want nothing more than that. But once those withdrawal symptoms start to kick in, it becomes extremely difficult to ignore that.
And so the urge there isn't, I really want to get high again. It's, I want to make these withdrawal symptoms go away.
Absolutely. We've heard people will share stories of, you know, while they're doing it, absolutely hating everything about what they're doing. But the relief of that pain, of those withdrawal symptoms can be so severe that they'll do it anyway.
I think there might be a sense from those of us who have happily not ever had heroin, have never tried it, that it's just a matter of willpower. You just got to gut it out and get through it. And so, is it that easy?
It's not that easy. If it was that easy, people that struggle with all addictions would quit much sooner than what they do. It really is not that simple, and that's one of the biggest areas that we struggle with trying to educate people on. It's not a matter of willpower. There is, you know, so many different variables that go into it. Some people, yes, they can just quit cold turkey. It happens. But the majority of people with all the willpower in the world aren't able to do that, and that's one of the challenges that we face.
So stepping beyond cold turkey, what else can an addict do? What else can they turn to for help?
Well, there is medical ways to help treat opiate addictions. You've got the Suboxone, as in Gina's case. There's methadone as well. There's also Vivitrol, which can be used as an injection once a month. Those, basically what they do is they help to reduce the withdrawal symptoms in a medically monitored way, as well as they don't cause quite the same high or intoxication, euphoric feeling that the actual heroin would cause.
But as Gina told us in Maureen's story there, if you're a person on heroin, you may not have the medical insurance, you may not have the job, you may not be able to afford these things.
Absolutely. It's one of the biggest challenges that we face. Unfortunately, even being a nonprofit, one of the first questions that we have to ask anybody that comes through here out of necessity is, do you have insurance? And that dictates often the type of treatment that a person will receive. We've known for a long time there's a lot of different ways that we can go about treating different individuals, different addictions. But because of funding for a lot of this, it's not a matter of best practices. It's a matter of what can we cover? What can we afford?
So somebody without insurance, what do they got? Is there anything apart from the cold turkey?
There is some, depending on, there can be county funding sometimes available for that. There is self-pay clinics. So here in La Crosse, they could go up to AMS of Wisconsin and pay for that out of pocket. It's not cheap, but they can do that.
Now you're on the front lines of dealing with people in addictions. What's on your wish list? What do you wish if you could have a magic wand and do one thing that could change to help people break this addiction?
I think increasing the access to appropriate levels of treatment. If a person is in need of an inpatient setting or a residential setting, that we're able to get that for them. And unfortunately, that's not the case at this time. Somebody could really need a residential setting, but they're only, because of funding or whatever, they're only going to get standard outpatient. So 1 hour a week with their counselor, and then we try to supplement that, get creative as best we can. So appropriate levels of treatment for anybody.
In our last minute or so, do you see the will there? Are people out there calling for these changes to happen in the political world, in the communities?
We're starting to have the discussions. Unfortunately, we're having those discussions because of the negative impact that it's having on our community. It's not proactive at all. It's been around for quite a while. We're just now starting to have those conversations, and that's, you know, that's our fault. We're you know, we wait and we're reactive instead of proactive, and so we are starting to have those conversations. There is some money starting to trickle through, but it's an uphill battle because, you know, we've waited as long as we have.
Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's Keith Lease. He's executive director of the Cooley Council on Addictions.
Tomorrow on Central Time, our series on the heroin epidemic in Wisconsin will continue with a look at the pros and cons of Narcan, one of the drugs used to help addicts quit.
Also coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we're kicking off another Wisconsin-themed segment, Hidden Wisconsin, looking at the unsung jobs that keep our state running.
And we'll also be taking a look at the relationship between dyslexia and creativity.
And we'll talk about American drug companies testing their drugs abroad where there are fewer restrictions.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time, and it is quite hot in our studio. It's hot out there, and we're inviting you to go to the Central Time Facebook page and tell us how you are dealing with hot weather in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. I'll tell you how we're dealing with it. We've got the lights down low. It's like nighttime in here. It's kind of working.
Yeah, it's moody. It's mood lighting.
It's moody. I don't know if it's a lot cooler, but it's something. Hopefully you're doing all right beating the heat today. Well, we're going to talk Legos right now. I'm a parent, and Legos have been a crucial part of this experience so far. Who knew? Child comes with own Lego set.
Yeah, I was a Lego kid growing up, and my kids, on and off over the years, they just keep coming back again and again to the Legos.
Which are lovely until you
step on them. Step on them. Well, our guest looked at the Lego company, how they work differently, what they might teach us about innovation and creativity.
Well, our guest is David Robertson. He's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His book is called Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to talk first about how big the reach of Lego is. Give us a sense of how iconic a brand this is.
Well, it got Toy of the Century at the end of the at around 2000. They're pumping out. I think they've pumped out about 80 bricks per person for every man, woman, and child in the world. They're doing tremendously well. They're growing like crazy right now. It seems like everybody has some story about Lego that they tell.
And there's Lego conventions all around the world, aren't there, even for adults?
That's right, led by adults. And separate from the company itself, groups of fans get together to show off their creations. If you haven't been to one, it's really an impressive experience.
Now, you talk a lot about how Legos are a child's toy that doesn't get relegated to the back of a closet after a couple of weeks. Why is that? What is special about Legos?
Well, what I really study is the management of innovation. And so the reason I wrote the book is, I mean, I have the same memories of the brand as it sounds like you two do. And also from my kids, too, watching them play with Lego. But what I was really interested in with the book was that Lego manages innovation really well. And one of the first decisions that they made was that they decided that they would make a system of play, not a set of toys. And what that means is that if you buy a box of Legos, then you know, you get a certain play experience, but then if you buy another set and another set, it, you know, as you add sets, you multiply the possibilities. And I think that was a pretty powerful insight, and that has really helped Lego expand over the years. And of course, the fact that you can buy a set today and it snaps together with the bricks that, you know, maybe you bought in the 60s or 70s is pretty incredible.
Well, so it's a system of play that can keep building on itself. You can start with the kits, but then from there on you can tear them apart and build something completely new, which parents love. And it's been a winning business model for Lego, but not always. And that's where your book comes in. So tell me how Lego first had its ascendance and then, I guess, its first fall.
So Lego started out as a carpentry shop in 1932, and a guy named Ole Kirk Christensen was making toys because he couldn't get enough wood to make furniture. He invested in a injection molding machine, a plastic molding machine, in 1947, started making plastic toys. His son took over the business and patented the brick in 1958. They continued expanding the business, you know, slowly and steadily. The grandson of the founder, a guy named Kjell Kirk Christensen, took over the company in the late 70s. And he introduced a couple of pretty major innovations. One was technique, the more sophisticated Lego with beams and pins and gears and motors. The idea being that kids would leave the brick at around age 10 or so. And he thought if you make a more sophisticated set, then teenagers would play with it. For the most part, that failed. But there was a group of 25 to 55-year-old men that loved it and continue to play with it. The other thing that he did that I think is even more important is the minifigure. The minifigure first came out in 1978, those little Lego people. And I think that's a pretty important innovation in Lego's history because it really personalized the play experience. I played with Lego before the minifigure. So, you know, I just made houses and cars and things like that. When you have the minifigure, it really becomes a much more immersive experience. You can play out roles and conflicts and stories. And I think that combined with the sets that he put them in, Kjell Kirk's Lego put out these space and castle sets, these fantasy sets, which had never existed before, launched Lego into a 15-year growth period where it doubled in size every 5 years for 15 years. But then in the mid-90s, the growth stopped. It plateaued. And what had happened is that they'd reached a kind of natural endpoint. They'd expanded into North America. They'd come out with lots of different sets, but there's only so many feet of shelf space in so many toy stores around the world. And so sales flattened. But they kept putting out more and more toys, trying to get that sales growth back. And so the costs were going up, but the sales weren't. So they suffered a big loss in 1998, had to lay off 1,000 people. And the grandson of the founder, who'd been running the company for 20 years, stepped aside and brought in a turnaround expert, a guy named Paul Plowman. And Plowman, he went out and he looked at the market and he saw that, you know, kids were moving away from traditional toys, not just Lego, but Hot Wheels and Lincoln Logs and Barbies. And also the distribution channel, the Toys R Us and the Walmarts were getting much more sophisticated about, you know, why kids bought what they did and much more powerful. And thirdly, all the patents that Lego had on the brick had expired. So anybody could make a Lego brick for cheaper. And Lego was making them in high-cost Denmark, whereas everybody else was making their toys in China. So other toys were getting cheaper. And so this was a recipe for a lousy industry.
So it sounds like, you know, Lego did what a lot of good companies would do in that scenario. They thought, we're going to innovate the heck out of this problem. We're going to do everything we can to find uncharted territory, go there. We're going to branch out. What happened?
Yeah, they did. And they experimented and they had a couple of hits. You know, they were really convinced that the brick was passé, that kids just didn't want to play with plastic bricks anymore. And so they challenged their designers to come up with just whole new play experiences. You know, some consulting firms pointed to Lego as a case study of what you should do if your industry is dying. And so they did. They experimented. And what happened is they ended up getting themselves into a lot of businesses they didn't understand. They made toys that were confusing to the market. I mean, if you see a Lego toy on the shelf and you look at it and it doesn't have much building as part of it, you know, parents would get confused and they'd walk away. And then they also ended up with some toys that just weren't that good. There was one toy called Galador, which had this TV show that went along with it that they commissioned from a Hollywood producer. And it had a video game, and it had the story behind it and electronics and so forth. And I looked it up, and nobody who acted in the TV show ever acted in anything ever again. I mean, it was so bad. And the
toy
failed.
It's a career killer, huh?
And there was no building as part of the toy. I mean, you could take the arms off and you could insert the arms into the head socket or, you know, I mean, but there was no real, there was nothing Lego-y about it. It was a mammoth investment and a terrible failure. And so there was a couple years of experimentation, and there's a couple things that worked. I mean, 1999 was the first Lego Star Wars set, which was very successful. Lego Harry Potter. There's a toy called Bionicle. There's a couple experiments that were pretty good that worked, but the problem was there's lots more that weren't Lego-y, that weren't popular, and that weren't profitable. And Lego kind of the problem was not that they couldn't boost innovation. It's that they boosted it too much and lost track and lost control of what was happening.
Yeah, it's interesting that they lost their faith in the plastic brick. That's kind of the core of their company. It sounds like they sort of got away from the heart and soul of who they were.
Yeah, and you know what's surprising about it is that what they've learned since then is that if kids play with those online games, like there's a whole series of games about Lego Star Wars, Lego Indiana Jones, Lego Batman, and if kids play with those, they actually want more Legos, not less. That there's nothing disruptive about it, to use a buzzword. So what happened was when they did all that experimentation, it worked for a while, but some of the big toys like Lego Star Wars and Lego Harry Potter were only big in years in which there was a movie. So there was a Star Wars movie in 99 and 2002. There was a Harry Potter movie in 2001 and 2002. There was no movie from either franchise in 2003 or 2004, the first half of 2004. And so sales of those two big toys fell off a cliff, and Lego was left with a lot of unprofitable, unpopular products, and they almost went out of business. 2003, they were really close to bankruptcy.
And that is a great cliffhanger. We're going to leave it there for now as we talk to David Robertson about his book, Brick by Brick, The Story of Legos. When we come back, we're going to find out how Legos came back, and you know, it's a comeback tale. We'll be hearing that in just a bit.
And we want to hear from you. You can call in at 800-642-1234. What are your Lego memories? Is your house littered with the little plastic bricks? Were they an important part of your childhood or your parenthood? Call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with David Robertson. He's the author of the book Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. And we're hoping to get your take on this, too. Why do you think Lego is special if you're a parent? Is there something special about the way Lego helps your kids to play that you value? And I'll also be curious, what's the coolest thing that you or your children ever built with Legos? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And David, we left with that cliffhanger. Lego was in the dump. Their profits had dipped off. What happened? How did they get out of that dump? Because I know there's a crazy chart in your book where all of a sudden you're seeing a whole lot of black. What happened to bring them back?
Well, what they did is they realized that all this out-of-the-box thinking, all this innovation almost put them out of business. And what they did is they went back to the brick. They went back in the box. And what they found was there was a lot of money in the box, that they'd been so focused on coming up with those great big innovations that they'd forgot about the little innovations, the police stations and the fire trucks that kids and parents loved. And when they went back in the box and when they started developing those kind of incrementally better versions of spaceships and fire trucks and police stations, they found that kids loved them and parents loved them, and they came back to the brand. But within that, there was also a lot of other things that they did to make it work better. One of the things that happened during the experimentation period between 99 and 2002 is that they let designers create whatever shapes and use whatever colors they wanted for the bricks and the toys they produced. And so the complexity got out of control. What they did is they cut that way down, and they forced the designers to work with a much more limited palette of shapes and colors. And that way they can make sure that those pieces were reused in lots of different sets. They're made in higher volume, and so they cost much less to produce. And they also narrowed what designers could do. You know, if you were a designer in 2001, you were told to create a great play experience. You know, the sky's the limit. Come up with something never seen before. Now, if you're a designer at Lego, you might be told to create a great, you know, fire truck or police station, and to do it in a very limited period of time with a limited palette of pieces, and also, you know, a very clear deadline. And that is a different kind of innovation, a different kind of creativity. You know, there's a lot of creativity involved in making something like that great. But some of the designers from 2001 were really unhappy and left the company. But others, you know, have told me that in a way we had to rediscover what Lego was all about. How do you take this limited set of pieces and reconfigure them in an interesting way and make something really great? And the other part that's rewarding about being in Lego now is that if they work on a toy, they're pretty sure it's going to get in the hands of a kid and, you know, be played with, whereas before, a lot of those ideas never made it to market.
Well, it's an incredible story. Well, let's get our callers in on this. We've got Jim, who's joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. You know, this is great. I could talk Legos all day. I have a story. When I told you, screener as a child, it taught me many skills of just organization and following the steps that were laid out, you know, process and thinking and critical thinking on it. But one time I put together a helicopter following the steps and I got stuck. My mother would not assist me. I slammed it on the floor. It shattered. I run off, tantrum, come back a couple hours later after cooling down, tore it back apart, started from scratch, and finished my project. But I use it nowadays as a sense of, you know, you just don't give up on something. You continue on until the project's done. And like I said, I think it's probably one of the best. I had toys in the toolbox for them to play with, to give them a sense on a rainy day or even a nice day outside. You can take them to your sandbox or anywhere.
Yeah, I love that story, Jim. I, too, have been present at these Lego tantrums and comebacks, so I know what you're talking about there. And David, does that resonate with you about part of what's so cool about Legos?
Oh, I think it is the spatial reasoning, the creative construction experience. I think, you know, Lego is a great investment in your kid's ability to support you when you're older.
That's important. I mean, there was actually, you know, an interesting article in the New York Times. I just glanced at the headline today, though, that said a child's spatial ability is linked to creativity. And it seems like Legos help that spatial ability in spades.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jim. And we move to Anne in Muskego. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
Hi. What's your experience with Legos?
Hi. Well, just from a parent's point of view, they're the best things that were ever invented. My son, who's 25 now, started with the basic Lego set, and I watched him make buildings and vehicles, and everything was symmetrical. So, you know, he was very detail-oriented about how he put things together. And then as he got older, he wanted the kits that had the smaller pieces, the Star Wars vehicles, things like that, which he spent hours, you know, working on. So I watched him do that and was amazed at how he could put those things together. Also, my memories, too, are of stepping on them in the carpet. Thinking, oh, what was that? And, you know, vacuuming up the little pieces and things like that.
Nothing hurts like a Lego, does it?
I know, those sharp corners. But, yeah, I can't say enough good things about Legos and how they teach children how to, you know, all their reasoning and skills, things like that.
So. All right. Well, thank you so much for that experience that you had, Anne. What do you think, David?
Well, you know, what I teach and what I study is innovation management, and specifically governance, you know, corporate governance of innovation. And that's a topic that if you start talking about it from that perspective, executives' eyes will glaze over and, you know, you'll lose their attention pretty quickly. But if instead of that, you can talk about how do you set up a system for innovation management in a company that gives teams the space to create, but also the direction they need to deliver, you know, the type of innovation that's going to be profitable and targeted to the markets you want to serve. But if you talk about it in terms of Lego toys, all of a sudden these kind of cynical 40-something executives, you know, turn into kids again, and they start, you know, getting playful about it. And when people act that way, they learn better. And so it's this Lego book is really a way for me to sneakily talk about some pretty important issues about corporate governance without it seeming that way.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. And another call here. We go to Paul in Mequon. Hi, Paul.
Good afternoon. This is actually brings up some great memories of childhood. As a young boy, boys, as you know, like to break things and wreck things. And we, my best friend and I made up a game called Demolition Derby Legos. And we would make cars out of them and crash them into each other. And the last one with the wheel on or wheel standing was the winner. So I actually still do that to this day with my own children. And as I shared with your screener, I love Legos, but the worst part of them is now that I'm a father myself is stepping on them. They hurt like heck.
I think we can all agree on that, along with their virtues, for sure. All right. Well, thanks so much for that, Paul. Demolition Derby with Legos. Yeah, there's so much creativity. And David, you were talking about how Legos are kind of a sneaky way to talk about, you know, some business management stuff. What are the lessons here for other businesses about how to get the job done?
Well, I think that there's a lot of books out there that talk about how to boost innovation and how to come up with the big ideas that are going to change your industry. I think Lego's kind of a cautionary tale. It's more about how you can boost innovation too far. You can lose control of innovation, and it can almost put you out of business. What you have to do is not just boost innovation, but also focus and direct it. And that's a hard balance to do, but Lego has done it well. I mean, the punchline of the whole story is Lego's performance over the last couple of years. For the last 5 years, the company's been growing sales at 24% per year, every year for the past 5 years, and profits at 40% per year, every year for the last 5 years. And that's because of their ability to manage innovation.
Do you think they get their due when it comes to companies that get acknowledgement in the media?
I don't. You know, I found five different most innovative companies lists, and Lego wasn't on any of them. They're not in the top 50 in any list of most innovative companies that I could find. So it's this great kind of untold story. You know, they're stuck off in Billund, Denmark, and there's really 3 hours of nothing in every direction from Billund. You know, people in Copenhagen think of Billund as out of touch with Copenhagen.
Oh, interesting. Well, I want to get your take on a Facebook comment quickly here. We're nearing the end of our time together, but Lee on Facebook writes, as a school teacher, I got to relive this engineering exploration by building Lego Mindstorms kits. My students have made programmable robots, rovers, sorting machines, and self-balancing segways. It strikes me that the future of science and engineering will be taught on Legos. What do you think? Is that possible?
The Mindstorms kit is an amazingly sophisticated robotics kit masquerading as a Lego toy. It's I also did Mindstorms with my kids, and it's really impressive that that Lego could come out with such a sophisticated but usable toy. And there's a nice chapter in the book about how they're able to involve their fan community. There's a number of adults who get involved with this in the development of the kit. And what they found actually is there's this buzzword called the wisdom of the crowd. The crowd almost became a mob, and they almost lost control of them. And what they found is that actually the wisdom of the clique, getting a couple of fans more intimately involved, was what really works, and then steadily over time expanding that. And they're doing that in lots of other different ways throughout the company now.
And David, did you build some cool stuff while you were researching this book?
You know, those adult fans of Lego who spend so much time with it, I used to kind of make fun of them, but now I've become one.
Awesome. I
looked around and my kids have all left Lego, and I'm the only one left in the house that still plays with it.
Well, maybe you'll have to send us a picture of what you made. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Robertson is the author of Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry.
He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He joined us from their studios. Coming up next, a Time Magazine blogger got our attention here in Wisconsin, wondering if our governor is gearing up for a run for president. That's coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.